Welcome to Soap, a story of the Tates and the Campbells, whose normal life is anything but normal, with co-hosts Tom Diamond, Vicky Ray, Jesse Fultz, and Keith Chalgo. Soap operas come and go, but there has never been a soap opera like Soap.
Welcome to the Trail Actions Podcast. And part of our soap presentation, we are interviewing Dinah Manoff. Hello, Dinah. Welcome to the Literary License Podcast.
Hello.
Hi, Dinah.
And with me, I'm interviewing Dinah today, is Vicky Ray. Hello, Vicky.
Hi, everybody.
So how are you doing today, Dinah?
I am doing just fine, thank you. I am on beautiful Bainbridge Island in Washington, and I'm having a lovely morning so far. I've had my coffee, so I'm ready to go.
It's still early there, kind of.
Yeah, it's just 9:30. Where are you?
It says here that
Dallas.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Vicky, and I'm in London, England.
Oh. Oh, wow. So, that's so wacky. Okay.
Yeah, it's amazing what modern technology can do now.
We grew up in the same hometown. Well, kind of. He ditched us and went British when he was like young.
So I thought what we'd do is we'll talk about your career and your childhood, and what better way to start is in the beginning. And it's like you are the daughter of Lee Grant, the writer, director, and actress, and the screenwriter Arnold Manoff. What was your childhood like?
Tense.
Tense.
I was born into a blacklisted home. My father was a blacklisted screenwriter, and my mother was a blacklisted actress. She had been blacklisted for not naming my father. And so the atmosphere in our home was not very Leave It to Beaver. It was like, you know, it was like a black and white movie with a lot of cigarette smoke going through the room. Men scribbling on yellow legal pads. You know, it was very intense. And my father was unable to work, and my mother was unable to work. And so my father got... with two other writers, they hired kind of a flunky to go out and sell screenplays for them. And then they were ghostwriting the screenplays behind the scenes. Oh. And that was the basis of the movie called The Front.
Wow.
Starring Woody Allen as the flunky.
Wow. Interesting.
A little blacklist trivia.
We've talked to other people that had similar experience in their childhood.
And what did your parents think when you decided you're going to acting? Were they, were they forthcoming? They were happy about it, or they tried to?
My father passed away when I was 9, so that wasn't an issue there. My mother, you know, I don't think in the beginning that my mother thought that I was going to be commercially viable, because I wasn't really an ingenue. And I was also kind of a juvenile delinquent in my teen years. So, you know, I didn't like put in the big work. I wasn't taking things really seriously as she had done. And when I started to get work, I think it was very surprising to her, you know? She was very, in those days, she was supportive, but very, very hard on me. Very hard on me. Something that I, in later years, trained her out of. And now she's just a pussycat.
You spent your teenage years in New York City in Malibu, California. What do you, How would you compare the two, growing up in two quite diverse ways of growing up, the New York way and the California way?
Well, gee, first of all, when we moved to New York, I was 9 years old. I mean, I'm sorry, when we moved to Malibu, I was 9 years old. Up until then, I had been raised in a neighborhood where everyone was Jewish, Black, Puerto Rican, Italian, Irish. Just mush. Then we moved to Malibu Colony, where everyone was blonde and quiet and repressed. So, I had spent my time in Malibu trying to fit in. Really, I was a square peg trying to get into that round little surfer girl hole. And, on the other hand, the beach was marvelous and beautiful. And the colony in those days in the 60s was really interesting. I mean, Cary Grant, Diane Cannon, Jack Warden. I mean, it was filled with really interesting artists and filmmakers and partying and smoking, drinking, never thinking, the cast of Peyton Place, I mean, Ryan O'Neill and Mia Farrow. And so there was an aliveness there artistically, but as a kid growing up, it was not so good for me in those years. Is that a good answer?
I can imagine that when there's an aesthetic that California tends to produce, it must be, we don't feel like you can fit into that aesthetic. It must be quite difficult.
Well, I think it's different now. But when we were there, Malibu was not the luxury site of, rich people. I mean, the colony had artists and actors, but the rest of Malibu was really just a middle class town. Most of the people there were aircraft workers. Rand McNally was the big company. And so it was a very different time.
I read that you said that you loved being a troublemaker at Santa Monica High, and you would smoke on campus and go barefoot.
Where'd you read that?
It was on your IMDb page.
Wow. Lord. Okay, well, that's true. I admit it. Yes, I was a troublemaker. I was a troublemaker. It's true. I was. I was a wild child.
And it looks like in the 1970s, you started your role in acting. What actually started you interested in acting to begin with?
I was completely unqualified to do anything else. That's the truth. That's the truth. I didn't like going to school. I did a year and a half of college at Cal Arts, where I mostly, was a troublemaker again. And I didn't want to be in school. I didn't have the discipline. And, what I had was I had talent and I had chutzpah.
Right.
And I started going out on auditions and I started going to acting class periodically because I was not a good student. I was not a person who could sit still, but I went on auditions and for whatever reason, I caught on as a great sidekick and character actor. And so I began to work and the work really fed me. I mean, the work gave me an identity for the first time that I felt connected to. I was about 19 when I started working. And soap was my first big job. I had a couple of little jobs. I guest starred on Welcome Back, Cotter.
I was going to ask you about that. What was that like? I loved that show.
Well, it was like, I don't know. I have this with Welcome Back, Cotter and soap, which I'll talk to you about. But it was like at that time, Welcome Back, Cotter was like the hot show on television. And right. I, everybody, including me, was glued to it. And everybody, including me, was in love with John Travolta.
Right.
So when I got the job on Welcome Back, Cotter, I was so intimidated and so excited And the part was that I asked Vinnie Barbarino, played by Travolta, to the dance, but he turns me down and I go with Horshack, which is kind of like the story of my acting career. I'm
always it was a Sadie Hawkins dance, wasn't it?
Nah, she ends up with Horshack.
Horshack was very lovable, though.
He was a darling. He was darling. But he wasn't Barbarino.
This is true.
Well, that actually brings us to Soap and your iconic role as Elaine Dallas. We had Jennifer Salt with us and we interviewed her.
Great. Yeah. Way back. We go back to the commie days of New York with the blacklisted parents.
Right.
We're all friends. And we're like, Ramishbucha.
I bet.
Yeah. But she was saying, because she said when she did stuff, she really, really enjoyed it. It was fantastic acting. But she felt like kind of out of place because you had these fantastic, great comedic giants like Richard Mulligan. And you always had to be on your guard because you just never knew where these people were going. So you kind of have to like be in the into that in the moment with them. And then you came in the middle of season one as
two. Danny's. I think I came in on season two.
Season two.
I think it was season two.
Oh, yeah. That's true with Danny's love interest. So what was it like to come into a well-established cast as a new character?
Elaine Lefkowitz.
Again, it was like walking into the pages of like a book you had been reading. You know, it's like, oh, my God, there's Bert. There's Mary. You know, there's the puppet.
Oh my God, it's so funny.
It really was like that, you know, again, because it was an iconic show and we were all watching it. So to get a job on it was like crazy, you know? And because I was such a new actor, mostly I was just intimidated a lot of my early career. Intimidated. And working with that caliber of actors was remarkable. I mean, that was really like, whoa. I mean, I knew I was in a place of privilege then. You know, I was honored to be there. I was honored to be saying Susan Harris's words because she was so brilliant and writing stuff that nobody else was writing. That character, it was the first time that I felt a character fit me like a glove, you know, that to be this loud Jewish, you know, mean.
Obnoxious.
to play with that part of myself was so freeing, you know, to not, because in those days as a young actress, mostly I was trying to repress myself, keep myself down, make my nose smaller, make myself petiter and quieter, because those were the roles I was going up for. So here was a chance to just blare, you know, trumpet my real stuff, you know. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
And you did it well.
I've been trumpeting ever since.
But you're comedic, you know, with Danny, though, that how you guys played off each other, you know, his anxiety and you're just, you know, hanging in there, just sticking it to him the whole time in that role. I mean, it's just fun to watch. It really is.
Yeah.
You also had to do a lot of like physical comedy with it as well. Was that your first shot of doing physical comedy? Because there's a lot of them.
It was my first everything. I mean, it really was. I mean, it was, you know, I think it was good that I didn't know what I was doing a lot of the time because I didn't put the brakes on a lot. I wouldn't have known where to put the brakes on. You know, I just went with my instincts. And I think it served the character well. I often wish I could have gone back later with more training. I think there were things that I wish I had been able to mine more once I really understood the craft of acting, which I was just flying by the seat of my little pants, you know. Mm.
I mean, I really love that character. And I have to sit there and say that I was really saddened that when she turned her new leaf, then she left.
I know.
She had her demise.
Yeah. But then she went off and did Grease. So she was.
True, you did.
Yeah.
No, actually, I think it was the reverse, but I can't remember.
Grease was 1978.
So, no, so Soap was first. Soap was
first. And then, of course, she got to be in a movie with John Travolta.
Yep, there you go.
Full circle. Yeah. What was shooting Grease like? Was it more of like an ensemble shooting, or was it more everyone kind of did their part and went back to the trailer kind of situation shooting?
No, it was very raucous and joyous and funny and fun and crazy and unpredictable. I think that, you know, the script was so good. You know, it was so cat. That's Darwin. That's our fat cat. our other cat's thin. Not all my cat are obese. it was really like professional summer camp, honest to God. And there wasn't a lot of angst in the filming. I had angst, but I still have, I was born with angst. I had angst because it was a musical. I'm not a dancer, as evident by the way they hide me in the dance numbers you'll see. I really felt like I was faking my way through most of it, but we had such a good time as a group, you know, the Sandra Dee scene, which is my favorite. That's my favorite scene that I partook in, because I felt really, really there with those women. We really were the bad girls, and Olivia really was the goody goody two shoes in real life. So, you know, so it was very authentic for us to be just giggling and torturing her and, you know, doing our boob exercises to shock her, because she was Olivia, not Sandy, was so easily shocked in those days that it was just, you know, we all had this little devil in our eyes doing the scene with her. So, so I always feel like, yeah, that was the one where I was really there, you know.
I always got a kick out of that one scene when you were with Vince Fontaine.
Yeah.
You know, and he was asking what your name was. Marty Maraschino, you know, isn't Jerry. Because you're just so funny the way he's looking at you, the way, you know, you're looking at him. Yeah, my mother still busts out laughing every time that one scene comes out.
That was a fun scene. Eddie Burns was great. He just passed away this last year. He was a fabulous dude, and
he looked like a lot of fun.
He was a lot of fun.
I find it funny that once Olivia Newton-John character changes in Grease, then the pop world, her music also changed. She became more sexier, didn't she?
Yeah,
she went from
that's true. That's
she went from please, Mr. Please to totally hot and physical, yeah. So on and so
I
forth.
I think that's true. And Olivia, once they sewed her into those pants, boy, I mean, we all, it really was jaw dropping for all of us. None of us could see that side of her, all like, what?
I didn't know how they got anybody. Huh? Anybody. She's so thin anyway at that point. It's like, how did they get her in those pants? Literally sew them on her. Yeah. Did they really?
Yeah, they sewed her in. And then they'd have to seam rip so she could go to the bathroom. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. That is wild. I did not know that.
What you do for performance.
Oh, my God. I guess that. But they looked very good on her.
Yeah. Yes, they did. Yes, they did.
And then it looks like from the 1980s after Grease, and you went into Broadway, I ought to be in pictures working with the Neil Simon play. What was your experiences on Broadway?
You know, honestly, I was the luckiest young actress in the world. And at the time, I just didn't know it. You know, we get the gift of retrospect as we get older, as I'm sure you know. And I look back and I think, I wish I had known then how extraordinary that moment was while I was living it, rather than in retrospect, because it was amazing. And Herb Ross was directing, and Herbert could be a very tough taskmaster, but he was also brilliant. And he really taught me to act for the first time. You know, they hired me for this role based on my nature, you know, basically on who I was in the room. And also, I had been cueing my mother on Neil Simon scripts from the time I could read, because she'd done two Neil Simon plays. She did a Plaza Suite and Prisoner of Second Avenue when I was a kid. And so that language and that rhythm was inherent to me. I could sing it. And Neil looked for that because he wrote such specific rhythms and pauses and, you know, ba-dum-bumps. His jokes were very, very finely crafted. And I brought that in. But what I didn't have was the chops to do eight shows a week for a year. And Herbert Ross really taught me to be an actress who had discipline and craft. And part of that was painful, and part of that was amazing. And it was transformational for me. Working with Neil, you could not change a word, a comma, an apostrophe with Neil. So you had to be very specific. And what Herb Ross taught me was specificity, that every sentence, every line had to be meaningful to me in some way. I couldn't just blab, you know, and be cute and funny. And that changed my creative life and process.
I mean, Neil Simon really speaks for a couple, you know, about three or four decades, wasn't he? Where he was, I mean, you know, everything from the beginning of his career all the way to the end. And it's kind of a shame that we're lacking a Neil Simon for the millennial, aren't we, really?
Yes.
Sort of thing. Yes, I think that's true. And I think that it will be interesting to see what incarnation that brings, because Neil was poignant without telling you, you know, this is a poignant moment. I mean, he found his tragedy in comedy. And so you could laugh and cry at the same time. You know, you would find yourself screaming with laughter and then, you know, and then he'd come and hit you, you know, in the heart. Mm. So he was an amazing talent, amazing writer.
There's always such a depth with his characters as well. Yeah. There's always, even if one, they look like they might be surface, but there's always a deep, deep well going on with every single one of his characters.
Absolutely.
And this actually led to you winning the Tony Award for Best Performance by a Feature Actress in a Play.
So yeah, what was that? Don't forget the Theater World Award, right?
Yeah, that was a big surprise. He really
definitely relished that moment.
Yeah, I did. But again, if it were to happen later, now, I was so taken aback by everything. Honest to God, I just wasn't all that, you know, I would say I was kind of body adjacent to all of it. You know, like it was almost like watching it happen to someone else. It was almost too much to take in for me at that time in my life. You know, I was, yeah, it was a lot.
Quite an achievement, though.
Mm-hmm. And then you got to do the movie version of the play you did on Broadway. What was that like? Because, I mean, they're two major, you know, especially if you're quite used to doing it, you know,
it wasn't
doing it
fun.
One way.
It wasn't fun. It was suddenly, for me, at least in my mind, I felt so much pressure. to be brilliant. And I felt so tight in front of camera. I didn't have what I had on stage. On stage, I was just free from the moment I walked on stage. I really, like, I'd walk on stage and I'd walk off and the play would have happened. I found, you know, real freedom in acting on stage, that when it came to that camera being on and those people watching and zoomed in like that, I didn't have it. It was terrifying to me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the good news was Walter Matthau and Anne Margaret, because being with them was so extraordinary. Herbert was directing, but Herbert had taken a tact with this movie that was not the play. He went very dark with it. He decided to make it a drama. And so that also put a weight onto the material that with the combination of, I think, my anxiety and that kind of weight, sparks did not fly, in my opinion. And I did not have a good time filming.
You also think that maybe also that when you do a stage show, that you have control of your performance. You can meter it the way you meet your performance. But when it comes to a film, that's actually taken away from you. That's actually in charge. That's actually left with the editor and the director to cut and paste what they want from you instead of what your performance should be.
Yes, and you can't build your performance, because you're filming the end of the play in the second week, and you're filming the beginning of the play at the end. And, you know, so unless you have a tremendous amount of experience and confidence, which I did not have at that point. I mean, I put it on me. I just didn't have it. I was really thrown. And I wanted so badly to be good. And that's a killer, because I was self-conscious. I wanted to be good and I wanted to be pretty. And that's killer for an actor, because then you're judging yourself all the time.
Right.
You also think that you also had the pressure of, you know, you did the show, you got great, you know, great critical acclaim for that show. Then you win the Tony, then you do the movie, and then there's like this huge expectation now.
Yeah, of course. Yes. That was all that. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the reviews came out and they weren't good. And it was very, very painful. I mean, it was very, very painful. It took me a long time.
I actually seen that movie. I actually enjoyed the movie, though. I mean, I've never seen the show on stage, but I actually did enjoy the movie. I remember when it was on HBO, and I think I watched it like 8 or 9 times. Like,
what is wrong with you?
I don't know.
You know, you would have liked it better on stage. That's all I can tell.
Yeah, well, most things are better on stage anyway. Well,
they are.
It's very rare that a movie actually beats out a stage performance. But I think it was I mean, if, you know, if I'm going to be honest and not sound like a super fan here, but I always found that with your performances, that when I watched them, that there was a likability about you that it kind of just always warmed me. And I would always watch your performances and just very, very enjoyed them. I just really,
I agree.
It's you always kind of gave in a performance. And even when you're playing the snotty person in Soap. And,
you know, still so likable. And
you're still so likable. And you always gave in a performance that, oh, I would like to get to know her and I could really be friends with her. That kind of
yes,
all
exactly.
That, you kind of, that you exuded.
It's true, though. I mean, I couldn't have said it better myself. Even if you were being, you know, like Carol or, you know, Lefkowitz or whatever you're playing, there was something warm and likable still about you. You still wanted to, you were so cute and likable, you know, and you could tell you were funny and you were bubbly and you had all this energy and you did bring it to your roles. And it is noticeable. It's extremely noticeable. That's what you were so likable. You had an energy that a lot of people don't, you know, convey to the viewer or, you know, to any of us that are watching. And it's very, it endears you to people. instantaneously.
Well, I send you both big Zoom hugs.
Thank you. Well, this also, though, I mean, though I ought to be in pictures, from what you're saying, the film didn't live up to the stage production of it, but you also end up doing an Oscar-winning movie called Ordinary People, yeah, playing Timothy Hutton's friend. What was that? What's like being on that? Because Robert Redford was pretty new to directing at that point, wasn't he?
Yeah.
I have a good story for you about that. It's actually very interesting. So I shot one day on that movie. They brought me into Chicago. I had screen tested for it. I believe, according to what I was told, that the part came down to between me and Marie Osmond.
No kidding.
Yeah. He was either going to go that way, like so unexpected, you know, that it could be someone like that. Also, they all lived in Utah, so I think there was something about that too. And, or me. I got the part. And so they brought me into Chicago to film for one day. And I loved Timmy. I mean, he was just amazing. And so we shot the scene one way, and then it was Timmy, the camera turned around on Timmy, and we shot the scene one way, and then Redford wasn't getting from me what he wanted, which was big turns of mood, and I didn't understand how to do it. So he had me shoot the scene all happy, and then he had me shoot the scene all down.
Wow.
And he edited together that performance, which
wow,
was genius to do. And so, and I actually, you know, that's a story that in the old days embarrassed me. Mm-hmm. And now I just love to tell because it's so amazing that he knew to do that with me. And it's a great scene. It's iconic, you know, really. They use it in, you know, acting classes all the time. They have
the team
work on this scene because it is such a complex little scene to play.
You were suicidal, weren't you, in the character?
Yeah, she commits suicide in the, not a spoiler. I mean, the movie's pretty old.
Yeah.
Did you get to meet Mary Tyler Moore at
I
all?
Didn't. Later in life, I did, but not on the set. As I said, I was in and I was out. You know, it was one. It was a one scene shot.
Mm-hmm. One shot. I often wonder what she must have been like on that, because I mean, she was the everyday good girl on television. Yeah. You know, the whole history of this, and this is
wholesome.
I mean, this is the one role that basically a switch, no character and her whole understanding.
What a
this
smart,
is like,
what a smart career choice for. Her.
Oh,
how smart of her to show that she was really an actress.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, it's like, I remember watching it and I was like going, I mean, she wasn't likable, but she was a bloody good actress.
Yeah.
But don't you think though it helped? I mean, like if you had, you know, like Louise Fletcher playing Nurse Ratched in Cuckoo's Nest, you didn't have anything else to base your reaction to her on. She was just awful. But with Mary Tyler Moore playing this role, you can't undo what you know about her. So it gives you some built-in compassion. What a genius casting that was, right?
Yeah.
So that you
don't really good.
Hate her, right?
True.
And, and it also freed her up to do so many different roles later on as well.
Yeah.
So smart.
Brilliant. And then in 1985, you moved on to a show on Broadway.
You were busy for many decades.
that I'm a huge fan of and have a soundtrack of the show regularly.
Come on.
Leader
of the Pack on Broadway.
Oh, God. Do we have stories about that? Probably none of which I can tell here. Michael Peters was our director, choreographer. He became a very, very close friend of mine. I miss him.
I
miss him. You know, that was at the peak of the AIDS pandemic. And so many of the beautiful dancers and actors from that period are not here. That's what I think of when I think of Leader. And I think of how if only it had been 20 years later, they would have had the antivirals and the medicine so that they, these young men, these beautiful talents would still be here. It was, Leader was kind of a marvelous fiasco. Ellie Greenwich was awesome. Darlene Love was stupendous. Patrick and I didn't get along, but in later years we made up. I was again intimidated and insane and blonde, platinum blonde, and trying to dance and sing, which are really not my strongest points in my talent. I mean, you know, it's not like you would say, who's the best singer and dancer we know for this part? Dynamite Off would not go off. But that was what was demanded. It was really hard. And oh my God, it was so hard. Ann Beats had written the book. I'm telling you everything. You know,
yes, you are.
You're just pulling it all out of me. I don't know. I must be having my filter's gone. Anyway, Ann Beats wrote the book. She and Michael hated each other. It was so crazy. And there was magic in the music. Real magic in the music. That's why I think you love the soundtrack. But what ended up on stage was kind of potchki. And if you don't know Yiddish, that means kind of just like, you know.
It lacked a well-flowing script that
it definitely works.
So Ann Beats had walked off and they had hired someone wonderful. Now I can't remember his name. It's probably on the liners. They hired another writer, and some of us were paying comics by the joke to give us something to say on stage. That's how patchworked it was. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it didn't work. It just didn't work. And, but
I mean, I've read the play script, so I have read it. So yeah. It's an odd show. I mean, to be honest, it kind of the beginnings of the jukebox musical, really, if you think of it that way.
Yeah.
The jukebox musical is such a big thing on Broadway and around the world with Mamma Mia and Rock of Ages and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
But I have to sit there and say that it's kind of an odd show because you're kind of like dealing with the life of Ellie Greenwich and, you know, her relationship with Jeff Barry and the way that breaks apart. But then you have Ellie Greenwich coming out every night as herself. So now you have a show that's kind of hard to put on anywhere else. I can't imagine a tour show.
Well, you know, it started off Broadway as a tiny little almost cabaret, and it was very successful. And it should have stayed. You know, it should have run its life there. It was very comfortable doing that. And, you know, trying to blow it up and to be the next Dreamgirls, it just didn't work.
Right.
I actually have to ask you, what was it like working with Annie Golden?
She's amazing.
I'm a huge fan of Annie Golden.
She's a genius. She should get her to come on your show. She's a very nice person.
I mean, Assassins, when she plays Squeaky Fromm, and in the movie Hair.
Oh.
In the movie Hair, she's so incredible. And in Orange is the New Black, you know?
Yeah.
She's fabulous and a great, great talent. And when she did her number of Leader of the Pack on stage, it worked. She knocked that number right out. She was great. Yeah.
And kind
and nice. Yeah.
She can sell snow to the Eskimos with her singing voice. Yeah. I mean, she's singing a love song about, you know, killing somebody for Charles Manson in Assassins, and she gets away with it. Not many people can do that sort of thing.
Not too many people can pull it off, that's for sure.
But I also have to sit there and say that one thing that Leader of the Pack, though giving birth to the jukebox musical, which you know, later on do quite well. But it's also one of the first musicals that actually would make a music video and actually release it to MTV and VH1.
Why don't what I? Because you actually got to make a music video. I do remember that. That's right. We did shoot that weird video.
That weird video.
I forgot all about that.
The MTV days.
Yeah.
Well, I'll look for that.
It's probably on YouTube, I'm sure.
I'm sure you're probably right.
But yeah, I kind of remember seeing that. I was like, oh my God, they're actually playing a Broadway, because it was like a medley, wasn't it, of the show? Sort of thing, like, you know, within a 30-minute medley of the show done in music video. And I think they had you all riding up on motorcycles up Broadway into the theater.
I literally forgot about it until you just said it. It was gone from my memory.
Now you have something to look up.
Can we get to the 90s?
Well, we got to talk about 1988 when you played Maggie Peterson in Child's Play.
You
can't get out of that one.
You're part of horror royalty now.
I know. Chucky's first victim. I know.
He just kind of launched you out the window.
Yeah, that was fun, actually. That was a fun shoot.
How much of that did you get to do?
Falling out the window. Well, they wanted me to do more. They actually wanted me to be the person who crashed through the glass. I mean, they make it, it's sugar spun. And I said, no.
Pass.
They said, well, you know, let's set it up and you try it. And so they set it up on a sound stage. And I tried it and I got cut. And I said, no, I'm not doing that. I am not stunt material. Just not. And so they had me fall backwards, and then they had the stunt person do the crash through. Yeah.
What was it like working with Catherine Hicks?
Oh, she's so sweet. She's just the nicest lady ever. You know, just like you'd think she is. She's exactly like you think she is. That's so lovely.
She met her husband on that show, didn't she? In that movie.
Yeah.
She likes in that. I mean, I know she didn't come back for any of the sequels, but we'll take that.
And there's been so many.
Yeah.
Whole franchise now.
Though her son's come back for all of them. The one who played her son, he's come back for them.
Oh,
now,
yeah.
So he's gone.
I've actually never seen the movie, but yeah. I don't like horror movies. They scare me. It's too scary for me.
I just remember going, I was living in Chicago. I just finished uni and I was in Chicago and went to go see it. And you came on. I was like all excited. Everyone's going, looking at me like, what's wrong with you? Sign that up. And my second thought was, what's she doing in this?
I was thinking at the time too, like, what am I doing in this? At the time, I had done a movie called Bloodhounds of Broadway, which I'd gotten paid no money for. None of us had, but it was like this insane cast with Madonna and Jennifer Grey and Matt Dillon and Randy Quaid, who at the time was sane. And so it was like, we couldn't believe we were doing this movie. But it paid nothing. And then I had this audition for Child's Play, which I thought, well, no one will go see this, but I can make 20 grand and, you know, put that in the bank. So Bloodhounds of Broadway disappeared, never made it out to the theaters because it was kind of a disaster. And Child's Play was like,
gold.
It's like, huh? boy, do I not understand.
Well, it's a bit like Betsy Palmer, who plays Jason's mother in the first Friday 13th. She's like, her car broke down. She goes, well, I need a new car. Okay, well, I got this. No one's ever going to see this.
That's what I thought about Child's Play. No one's ever going to see this.
And she goes, and it haunted her to the end of her life.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, this actually led us to going back to TV, working with Susan Harris again with Empty Nest, which was a spinoff of The Golden Girls, and you got to work with Richard Mulligan again. So, how did you have to audition, or did they ask you to?
Yeah, I had to audition. not only did I have to audition, I got a lecture from them before. They said, if you do this part, they were a little concerned about my self-discipline in, you know, if the show ran a long time and me showing up, because in the old soap days, you know, I was still quite a party girl. And so they were a little concerned about my behavior. And I assured them that I was now a very well-behaved, disciplined actress, and that I would give
all my, grown up.
I was all grown up, and that I would give my soul to play this part, because I felt that part was written for me. I just thought there's no one who could do this but me, and I was right. It really was mine. And I had such a good time playing her.
You all had such great chemistry.
I had such a good time playing her. And it came at such a good time. It came in my life at a time when I was ready to have fun acting, when I was no longer intimidated or self-conscious or self-obsessed, or, you know, I'm a little self-obsessed, but not in the way that I had been. You know, where I was really present for the experience of being with Richard, of being with Christy, you know, and getting to, it was like a great dance, you know, getting to work off of each other with really good material, especially in the first couple of years when the first writing staff was there. And I had a blast. And I am so grateful for those 7 years. I grew up a lot. I learned a lot. I did some, you know, work that I'm proud of. Some, you know, some I could have done better, but it was great. It was great. And Richard was the menschiest mensch of all time. I loved him with all my being. And he was a great captain of that ship.
He was very talented.
Yeah. You also got to direct a couple episodes.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy the experience of directing?
Yeah, I was planning to make a career out of it. I directed 4 or 6, I can't remember. They let me direct because they saw by year 5 I was going crazy. It was too many scenes around the kitchen table for me. And I was like, I was bored, you know, and restless, and they came to me and offered me the chance because they knew, because I was always telling them how I thought the scene should go. Anyway, so they said, let's channel that energy into something productive. And I loved directing. It came really naturally to me, especially the four camera take. Was easy, where you snap the scenes. It was really fun for me. And
you could tell you enjoyed it because, especially your scenes with Christy McNichol, or, you know, I think, what was the, there was one episode, I think, that you were supposedly slept with Charlie.
Yeah. he and I are still really good friends, as are Chris and I.
I'm glad. We love each other. We kind of miss her, you know. Looks like she settled for family and quiet.
Well, she, you know, Christy very openly and very honestly battled with bipolar disorder. And she found that the stress of the show at a certain point was not conducive to her health. And she was very wise to put her health first.
Yeah.
And she stopped acting. I mean, she hasn't acted since. No. Mm-hmm.
I also think she's part of that whole pussy child actor and everything like this. That had to keep up so much of herself hidden away that she probably can just be herself and live her life and do whatever she feels she wants her life to go. So there's a lot more freedom.
She's one of the coolest humans. She blurbed my book. She
blurbed it.
She did a blurb for me on the book. Mm. She loved the book.
I actually have her album.
I guess even the Christian
Dream album. Yeah, of course. Yeah, I do, actually.
If there is anybody that has done anything, a soundtrack, or, you know, he's probably got Captain Kirk's album somewhere, you know, laying
the thing
around.
Is,
he's got them all.
She's saying he's so fine, and you were leader of the pack, so there is a bit of a chemistry there.
She did the Pirates of Penzance. That was like one of my favorite movies. It really was when I was young. I loved that movie. But you did a, you, I had to ask because I had read in a couple of different places that your mother, who's also Oscar Award actress, she appeared on one episode and you guys had worked together for the first time. And it didn't seem like it was really that good of an experience for both of you.
Yeah, it just it wasn't one of our better scripts, actually. And so my mom felt kind of hung out to dry, and I felt very codependent. You know how that shit goes.
Yeah.
Old family of origin stuff kind of rearing its ugly head on the set of Empty Nest. That was what happened. And, you know, we've worked together in other ways that have been more satisfying.
Right. Well, as Lee Grant, you know, she's quite an icon as well. And there was another icon I needed to ask you a story about, was Bea Arthur. Something about bubble gum chewing.
She was such a pain in the ass. Oh my God. Bea had a rule over on the Golden Girls set. You know, we were a crossover. We were spin-off right. The Golden Girls, and then we would do all these crossover episodes. So on one of my crossover episodes, I went over and I was chewing gum, and someone said, "Oh my God, don't let B see you." I'm like, "What?" And they said, "You're chewing gum," and they were like shaking. You know, I was like, "Really?" So of course, because my nature is then to see what happens in front of B, because I kind of couldn't resist. I mean, like, that was the worst thing that was going to happen. She was going to kick me off the stage and I'd walk across back to our stage. I mean, really, you know, how bad could it be? So I just kept on going and chewing gum. And sure enough, boy, she just started to, "What are you doing? Spit that gum out right now," she said. And I said, "Really? What is it about? Just spit it out," she said. So I went and spit the gum out. But it was very interesting quirk.
But she came over to Empty Nest and you were chewing gum and she asked you to take it out again or something like that?
I'm sure that happened, but I don't remember. I am absolutely sure that happened. And I'm sure
you said no.
I'm sure it was me provoking her because I just couldn't resist. I really liked Bea a lot. I liked her very, very much and, you know, had such respect for her talent.
Yeah, she was all them girls at Golden Girls. That was just quite the run. I mean,
it was fun going over there. And
I still watch it.
Estelle became a regular on our show and we got to be very, very close while she was with us.
It was kind of weird how the pilot worked out, though, because you had Rita Moreno and the doctor that didn't have time for, you know, why the doctor didn't have time for Rita Moreno. I mean, one will probably never know, but it didn't really end up like that. It kind of took a totally different form for Empty
Nest. He didn't have time for Rita Moreno because Angie Dickinson was coming in season two.
Oh, is that how it works out?
I just made that up.
Oh, you had me going there.
I mean, Golden Girls is quite an interesting thing because, I mean, basically it's three iconic actresses, wasn't it? Estelle Getty, I didn't know too much about what she did before, but I mean, you had three iconic previous TV show actresses, you know,
right.
You know, Bea Arthur, Maud, you know, and of course, you know, Betty White and the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and Rune McCallahan did Maud and various other things.
Do you ever hear from Betty White still? Or
no, I haven't seen Betty in years.
Okay, so what we're going to do is then from there you did various films. I was going to ask you one more where you did a guest appearance was in Blossom because you got to work with your first love on TV, Danny, and Blossom. What was that like working on that show?
I don't have much memory of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was a week's work, wasn't it? For I can imagine, sort of thing.
You know, those little guest spots were so, you know, I mean, you'd walk in, you'd walk out, basically. I don't really remember it being much. But yeah. You tell me, what did I do?
You had nurses too. You did two episodes on that. Yeah.
No, so there was well, a couple in, of in Blossom, you, of that whatsoever.
Yeah, in Blossom, you came across as I can't remember Blossom's father's character name.
Right.
But you came across Fred. It's like I kind of dated him for like a, you know where they go. You go on a date. It might go into something, and that character's never seen again. One of those episodes.
I clearly did not make a big impression in my mind. Although I do remember Mayim coming over to our set. And I loved her. I mean, she was a little kid then, and she was already extraordinary. There was no question that she was like, whoa, you know, like off the charts brilliant. Yeah.
Well, you can see that in Beaches when she's playing young Bette Midler. I mean, you're like...
Amazing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Now you're a writer, and you got a book coming out. So you want to tell us about what your
book's about? I have a novel coming out called The Real True Hollywood Story of Jackie Gold. It is not a memoir. It is fiction and loosely based on some of my experiences, of course. But this is a novel that was inspired by the death of Princess Diana at the hands of the paparazzi.
Yeah.
And at the time when I came up with the idea, this was pre-cell phones when I was acting, and the paparazzi were showing up at my house with cameras, and I felt very violated and invaded. And it set me to thinking about what if it had been a big movie star who had been pursued by the paparazzi and wound up in the hospital in a coma.
Right.
And so that's the book. The book is this very big movie star is in the hospital having jumped off a balcony to get away from the paparazzi. She's in a coma. She recounts her life story from the hospital bed. It is funny and also touching. And it goes back and forth between her life and how she wound up there in present day. And it also deals with her fight for her life in the hospital. And so it took me a long time to write it. You know, I happened to have three boys at various times over the last, you know, 20 years. And so so writing was on and off and on and off for me. And it's got a release date July 20th now with a wonderful publisher, Star Alley Publishing.
Did you enjoy the writing process?
I love writing. I love it so much that I had to not do it because it was really interfering with my parenting. Because at a certain point, I was like, go away, mommy's writing. Not the kind of children I wanted to raise.
Right.
So I stopped. You know, I really did put it on hold for a long time and came back to it when they were like saying to me, go away. You know, I'm watching television. So I'm like, oh, mommy's writing. So that's what I did.
And do you think you'll be doing some more writing in the future?
I hope so. You know, I'm interested to see what happens with this book. I have another book that I'm, you know, playing around with. And
excellent.
Show you The Real True Hollywood Story of Jackie Gold. By
that's why you probably have to tell everybody it's not a real story.
Yeah.
Kind of, sort of.
Yeah.
Because it looks like something that could kind of be real.
Yeah.
And pre-orders for Kindle are available now, you're saying?
Yes, pre-orders for Kindle are available on Amazon, and my website, dinamanoff.org, will have links to pre-orders for the book. If it's not up now, it'll be up soon, because we're just in the process of getting all that organized, and then the official release date is July 20th, and you'll be able to get it everywhere. It will be
awesome. So glad to see you not slowed down that much. You still got that perky energy so that we admire so much and love about
you. Oh, I'm going to take a nap after this. Are you kidding?
So will Keith.
I'm done.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us at Literary License Podcast, Diana, and we totally enjoyed it so much, and I can't wait to read your book, which I actually have a sneak peek of the copy of the book that your agent sent me, so I'm looking to read that, and I'll be getting word out on that, and
we will,
and I can't wait to see what you have coming to us in the future.
Such a pleasure. Really
was. Thanks for having me. I miss you both already.
Yeah, we'll miss you, and we'll be looking for your future endeavors and be cheerleading on the side for you.
Thanks.
Yeah. And hopefully you'll find writing is rewardable as your co-actor, Jennifer Salk. She said that writing is, once really she got into writing, liberating. She said it was the best thing that she's ever done. So,
yeah.
So, okay. It's good night from us, and we'll see you next time with the Literary License Podcast. Thank you.
Bye.
No, I'm not doing very well. I built a lot of dreams, but they fell down to that too. Yes, it's true. I never thought he'd say goodbye, but when the music changed, I felt the magic die. Oh, why? Oh, why? We were standing at the top, but the panic wouldn't stop. The chapel of love fell down with the English beat all around. I don't wanna turn the pages, rocking ages. Oh mama, I'm calling, but no one listens to me anymore. And daddy, I'm falling. Please catch me like you always did before. When the innocence was gone, it was gone, can't go on. I try to sleep away the pain. I can't keep the tears from falling like the rain. It's insane, all this pain. Yeah, I've been hiding. My world's colliding. Is she ever coming back to town? I don't wanna turn the pages. Rock on ages. Mama, I miss you. Wanna be with you. Mama, you always knew how to help me. Daddy, I miss you. Wanna be with you. Wish you could come back just for a little. Oh, Mama, I'm breaking. Please take me and hold me in your arms tonight. And Daddy, I'm shaking. Please wake me. And tell me everything's all right. Mm-hmm.